Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
All right, here's David Culley on Saturday talking about Phase 2 coming up. We had rookies over this past weekend, and soon Phase 2 will begin, OTAs, and the vets will be here with the rookies. Here's David Culley on Phase 2.
I'm going to hold this whistle up again, John. I'm excited to be able to get out there with them for the first time. We've had our veterans now for about 4 weeks, strength and conditioning on Zoom meetings, putting installs in, our coaching staff has. And starting on Monday, we get to do the same thing, but we get to get some field time with them. And basically, we're going to kind of do what we just did, start with our mini camp schedule that we've done with these guys we just got through with, and kind of start that with our veteran group that's coming in here and kind of restart again and, get them into the culture. John, we've got 30 new guys on this team right now. It's a brand new football team. So we want to make sure that they understand from day one what we're all about and where we're going and what we're trying to get accomplished. And that's what we want to do for the rest of the offseason.
It's a brand new football team. Seth, he mentioned this multiple times throughout his press conference on Saturday, David Culley. Use that phrase multiple times. This is a brand new football team. It's almost a tacit admission that this is essentially an expansion team that he's coaching, like a souped up expansion team that he's coaching here.
I guess, yeah, and it's partly
expansion teams, so I'll let you be the expert on that.
But I was on expansion teams when they still had their original coach.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit more like when the one time I've been on a team where a new head coach came in, it was with Gary Kubiak.
Yeah.
And then just from watching the NFL forever, every time new coaches come in, it's all about changing the culture, and this is a new team, and we're going to do it this way. You know, when Kubiak came in, Dom Capers' culture was trash. When Bill O'Brien came in, Gary Kubiak's culture was trash. And now with David Culley, when he's coming in, Bill O'Brien's culture was trash. Mm-hmm. And the new guys are going to put up new motivational posters, and it's going to be a brand new culture. But especially with this team, It's very much it's a new team personnel wise. I was trying to find stats on turnover, on roster turnover, and usually a lot of it doesn't come out until later in the year, like after training camp.
Yeah.
Usually opening day we might see some stats. I'm guessing the Texans are going to have more new players on opening day this year for their opening game than any other team in the league. There'll be more guys who play that weren't on the team last year. And that's just, it's been that kind of a year because there's just so much turn. There's going to be, the Texans will definitely have the most guys who play in September who maybe weren't even on the roster in April. It seems like all of this churn that we've had already is going to probably continue through training camp too. There'll be some guys they don't like during training camp that they'll get rid of. They'll bring in some guys for preseason game number two or three and just get used to it. Buckle up. There's going to be a lot of personnel changes.
Yeah, I wouldn't settle in on anybody's jersey. Let's just put it that way. You know what I mean? Like, if you happen to fall in love with a guy who signed here as a free agent before the season and you go get a customized jersey, I would rent, not buy, as they like to say, when it comes to settling on who your players are going to be. Seth, you just mentioned it. So you were here for a coaching change from Capers to Kubiak between 05 and 06. I wasn't here for that. Was the turnover of the roster anything close to what Nick Caserio's been doing with this team?
I don't think so. There was, if anything, it seemed like it didn't really. Well, you know what happened, Sean, too, was that there was a GM change in the summer of that year.
Yeah.
The Kubiak came in, and Kubiak ran the draft with Charlie Casserly.
Right.
And then Casserly was let go after the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Smith was hired sometime that summer. So that was, excuse me, Sean. So that had a markedly different feel. Yeah. That was, boy, now that I think about it, I wonder if they were talking about that a lot on sports radio. When I was just a player, I don't know. hold on.
There we go.
The almond people are out to get me. Somebody poisoned my almonds. So, yeah, no, so this feels a lot different than it did then. This was also, I mean, we didn't have, with Kubiak coming in, he was very much the coach, right? Like, he was a guy that everybody expected that Kubiak was going to be the guy, and everybody was hoping he was going to be here for 5, 6, 7 years or more. And it had a markedly different feel than what David Culley is right now. Kubiak had a system. Kubiak was going to run his offense because he'd been a coordinator for a long time, and it had sustained success as an offensive coordinator, albeit with John Elway as his quarterback, obviously. But it was just, there was a lot more clarity. There was a lot more known. Where now, people aren't really sure whether Culley's even, like, is it even part of the Texans' master plan for Culley to be here in 3 years? It wouldn't surprise me if it's not part of their master plan to have him in here in 3 years.
Sure, yeah, I mean, they would obviously never say that. But, yeah, if you're a reasonable person looking at what the trajectory of this team is over the next few years, it's a team that's probably not going to win a bunch of games over the next couple of years. Let's just call it what it is. Here's one more from David Culley on the importance of getting a good look at Davis Mills in camp this year.
Well, the one thing we liked about him, and Pep talked about this when we were sitting down with Nick talking about what he was all about in the evaluation process, is he's very accurate. You know, he gets it out on time. He's very smart. He understands the passing game because they do a very good job of it there at Stanford. He's been in a very good play action, run action type pass game, which we have had a history of doing here. And he fit what our model was from wanting to have a guy at that position.
All right, so that's Culley on Davis Mills. My favorite part of that, Seth, was when David Culley says, you know, he fit the play action, run action, passing game, which we do a lot, which we've done a lot of here. I'm like, you've never coached a game here. What are you talking about? You do a lot of it? At practice yesterday?
You know what, though? Maybe that's a little bit of a tell.
Yes.
I would imagine, you know, they're going to try to build on some of the success they had at Baltimore. And Baltimore, as much as it's a quarterback run game driven offense, you can still do a lot of the same concepts out of a more traditional offense with the Texans. You know, they're going to line up, they'll be pulling guards, they'll be running and playing power football, they'll be doing a lot of those same concepts. They just won't have the benefit of with Davis Mills, they wouldn't have the benefit of it. With Tyrod Taylor, they'll have the benefit of some mobility there. Now Tyrod Taylor's also, like, he's getting up there in years by now. Because remember, he was in Baltimore for a while before he got his shot with Buffalo.
Yeah, I think he was drafted in 2010.
Yeah, I don't – Tyrod Taylor's not a guy that I would feel comfortable out there running the ball 10 times a game, or however many times a game Lamar Jackson was running it.
How old do you think Tyrod Taylor is? I got his wiki page up right now.
I bet he's 32.
He turns 32 in August, so he'll be 32 when the season starts. He was drafted in 2011. Six-round pick. I mean, that's about as good as you can get with a six-round pick, man. Unless you're Tom Brady, of course. Yeah, I'm with you. Tyrod, I mean, Brady's as good as you can get.
Oh, was he taken in the sixth round? I wasn't aware of that.
Tom Brady? Yeah, no, I don't know. You should look it up, Seth. I'm not sure. I think it was the sixth round. So Tyrod Taylor, he's going to be 32 years old. I got a text from Coach Lees over at Episcopal, who, of course, had a couple players taken high in the draft, including Jaylen Waddle, got his rookie deal signed, millions of dollars. He's a millionaire now, Walker Little. Coach Lee, Seth, coached Spencer Rattler at the All-American game coming out of high school, and he was the top-rated kid coming out. He says, a lot like Baker with a better arm, he says. That's his scouting report on Spencer Rattler. So he coached him in an All-Star game. When he was coming out of high school,
Boy, that would be – I'm a sucker for an arm. I mean, that's a I wanted Patrick Mahomes over Deshaun Watson when the Texans first drafted Deshaun Watson. The interesting thing about that was that I think I admitted that by the end of Deshaun's rookie year, after he got injured, said, well, you know what, maybe I was wrong on that, on Pat Mahomes over Deshaun Watson. Wish I had never said that. It's starting to look like perhaps. At the very least, I don't know. You know, in different systems, if Deshaun had gone to play for this isn't even a hot take. If Deshaun had gone and played for Andy Reid in Kansas City, he would have been a better football player faster.
100%.
You would have been a more complete. But, you know, I mean, that's not even – that almost feels like an objective statement, because Andy Reid is a proven coach and offensive coordinator in the NFL compared to Bill O'Brien, or at least has a proven track record.
Deshaun might be an MVP by now if he had played for Andy Reid.
And so I'm not saying that Deshaun is – because of that, Deshaun's better than Patrick Mahomes or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I also know that so far Patrick Mahomes has generally, as far as we know, behaved himself – and conducted himself like a professional with massage therapy.
Yes.
Whereas Deshaun at the very least has admitted to not acting like a professional with his massage therapist.
Right. Correct. By the way, nothing from over the weekend in the Deshaun Watson case. We had fireworks on Thursday and Friday of last week, and then things settled back down again. So we'll be keeping an eye on that for sure as we roll on here through the off season. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Tuesday. If you do this, I think you should be arrested for mental assault on another human being. We'll tell you what some person did to a college football player coming out trying to make the NFL. This story, it's a bad story, man. We'll get to it next. All right, I'm not a big prank guy. I'm not big about playing pranks on people, especially when you're kind of toying with them mentally on things like this story. This story of this potential NFL rookie, Seth, this Wontarius Bryant. I don't know if you guys have heard this story. There is a defensive back from the school, Austin Peay, who was undrafted, and he thought he was heading to Georgia this weekend to try out for the Atlanta Falcons during the team's rookie minicamp. And when he arrived in Flowery Branch, and Flowery Branch, I guess, is the name of the town where the Falcons conduct their rookie minicamp, he learned he had been the victim of a hoax instead. He was never actually contacted by the Falcons. Instead, he was contacted by someone texting him from an Atlanta area code, pretending to be the defensive coordinator for the Falcons, Dean Peace. So Bryant arrives at the team's facility on Wednesday to get ready, thinking he's getting his chance to fulfill his NFL dream. And instead, he shows up and they're like, "Who are you?" And he wrote in a Twitter message, "I don't know or understand why this happened, but I do know that everything happens for a reason. This was heartbreaking for me, but just another stepping stone that I'm not afraid to admit or overcome. At the end of the day, this will not make or break me. I will still continue to fight for my dreams. I know it's what I really want." He posted a more lengthy missive about it on his Twitter page and just said it was one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened to him. And I can only imagine, Seth, you show up at an NFL facility with your gear and you're thinking you're getting a chance. I mean, not only is it heartbreaking you're not getting that chance, but to have a bunch of people with an NFL team be like, "Who are you?" Like, they probably look at you like you're not all that intelligent, that you got catfished by somebody.
Yeah, that's like, and then I guess when you tell people about it too, that's what I'm always, I was like, why did he even tell anybody? How did somebody figure this out? That's the part that's really heartbreaking. This kid's so innocent that he believed this. I'm trying to figure out how. I'm guessing the guy catfishing him said that, "Hey, we'll reimburse you for your travel expenses," or maybe because it's just a tryout, so we don't have it in the budget, so we're not flying you in, but we'll reimburse you. And he got there, and I suppose just showed up at the facility. I'm trying to think of the logistics of it. Because first you had to go to the security guard, or you go to the receptionist. Like, if you walk up to the Texans facility, you got to go in to the main area there. And you have to say I'm.
Well, for the last year, you've had to take a COVID questionnaire as well. You know what I mean?
I'm Jontarius Bryant. I'm here for my tryout.
Yeah.
And then there's probably a whole lot of shuffling of papers and people trying to figure out what's going on, because nobody's going to assume that the guy's crazy. He's an actual guy. He played college football, and they're.
But he may not have made it past the gate, Seth. I mean, that may have been...
No, I know. Well, right. But somebody's going to be, like, looking for it and saying, like, okay, wait a second. There must be somebody here that wants to work this guy out.
Right.
And something just got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
So maybe this was this guy's plan. Is it wrong of me to maybe wonder if maybe Jontarius Bryant himself... concocted this story and showed up and said, oh my God,
boy.
Hey, I was told I was going to get a workout. Sorry. Oh, I was wrong, but well, I'm here anyway. So what do you say?
That is actually a nefariously genius plan to try to get that. You know who should have tried that, Seth? That dude who used to stand outside NRG Stadium back in the day. The wrecking ball. Remember that guy?
The wrecking ball, yeah.
He should have tried that.
Somewhere.
Yeah, he should have tried that.
He had his stats and everything. Yeah, right. I remember he benched a lot and squatted a lot.
Right, right.
I think he might have claimed that he had a 40 time that was probably a little bit sketchy.
A little fabricated, yeah.
You know, he used to come to some of our station stuff. When I was first back in town in like 2012, 2013. And he would still, like, talk smack. He would, it was weird. It was really weird. I think there was part of him that wanted to try to block me, like, in the middle of the bar or something.
If you do this to a college football player, I'm gonna go on the assumption that Wontarius Bryant did not, catfish himself to go with the, hey, I'm here already, why not give me a tryout approach? But boy, that is a next level thought right there. I'm going to go with he actually got catfished. You're a horrible, horrible person if you do this to somebody.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that would be that's about one of the worst things you could do that isn't a physical violence against somebody. That you just publicly humiliate them, let them believe that they've got a crack at their dreams or what have you. I guess the only other little conspiracy theory I might have is okay, what if he deserved it? What if this is...
Hold up. What if he deserved to have his hopes and dreams built up?
What if whoever did this to... his coach calls him Juan. So he says Juan has handled this situation with class. I hate the situation and have talked with representatives at the Falcons. All parties involved are frustrated. What if Juan had been like constantly making fun of some other guy that was trying to get a tryout or something? And
like he's
and
a bully or something like
never,
that?
You'll never make it. You ain't got what it takes. Yeah, that kind of stuff. And kind of trounced all over this kid's dream.
Boy.
So this kid says, all right, you know what? You know what? I'll show you.
Is that a proportional response to catfish him so he shows up at the facility?
Do you think the guy thought he was going to buy it? This might have started, Sean.
Yeah.
This might have started out as a semi-innocent joke.
Yeah.
This might have started out as just, hey, I'm going to mess with Wontarius and get him to think that the Falcons want to give him a tryout or something. Let's see how far we can
take. Boy, that is a mean prank, man. That is a mean,
Oh, it's mean.
Prank.
Yeah, I'm not denying that it's mean.
That's a mean, mean prank.
There's something about it that doesn't smell right. Why the hell did he tell anybody? I don't know. That's the part that I don't get. I would never tell anybody this. I would be sitting in my apartment stressed out. I definitely have got like 2 weeks left on it because it's my senior year in college or whatever. Just stressed out that anybody was going to find out about
this. This is why I think he did it. In this day and age, you post a story like that where you've been a victim of something like this. There's 32 teams in the NFL. There's going to be somebody with a soft heart out there who winds up giving him a tryout because of this.
Yeah.
Because there's no, I mean, they're not, if they bring him in for a tryout, there's no rule that says they've got to keep the guy. But if they're the team that gives this guy a tryout, then they're the team with a heart of gold. You know what I mean? This was a horrible thing that happened to this kid. You know what? So we're going to give him 30, 60 minutes at our facility to go run some 40s for us and go, backpedal for us at a practice here, blah, blah, blah. He will, I promise you, he will wind up getting a tryout out of some team feeling sorry for him because of this story. That's my prediction. It's my Wontarius Bryant prediction.
If you think about the one thing, I guess, if you want one thing to follow you around on Google, is this the thing you'd want to follow you around in your next life? Now, in his mind, he's probably thinking, okay, if it gives him an opportunity, then so be it. And then he'll go on and he'll make the team. And then it'll be a pleasant little footnote to his story,
yeah,
which I can appreciate. That's pretty good motivation. There's sometimes, hey, It's a good motivator. When you got something on your Google results that you don't like, the only thing you can do is go out and do something of more notoriety, something that's more notable to try to push it down onto the second, third, or fourth page.
You can't tell me about it. I've been trying for 5 years to do something that'll get that damn video of me getting my back waxed in that challenge thing that we did. To be the first thing showing up for me. One of my son's
buddies.
Everybody
Google it right now so it raises in the
No, ratings. Don't do it. Yeah, Sammy came into town with one of his buddies over the weekend. And, you know, he's like, hey, Mr. Pendergast. And he's asking me all these sports things and stuff like that. He goes, by the way, that video where you got your back waxed on YouTube is hilarious. And I'm like, oh, Christ's sakes. Come on, man.
I know a guy in Florida who owns a ton of a franchised restaurant. You know, but he was bankrupt in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, his bankruptcy was kind of a notable bankruptcy. And he wasn't a famous person. That was the first thing that popped up if you Googled his name. And I talked to him about it when he was like on the rise. He would talk about how, I got it onto the second page when you Google now. That was a big step for him.
Because
some random, like, you're about to do business with somebody, you don't want that the first thing, you don't want the first thing they see to be your bankruptcy.
Yeah.
But then he got to the point where he became so fantastically successful that a bunch of stories were written about his bankruptcy and how he came back from his bankruptcy. So ironically, now that he's basically untouchable in terms of wealth, the first thing that pops up are stories about his bankruptcy. But he's cool with it.
Yeah,
because there are always all these nice stories about him fighting back over the course of 20 years from his bankruptcy.
That'd be the best thing, dude. If you have a story, if they Google you and the first thing that comes up is a story of overcoming adversity, that's the best you can hope for, man. To me, like, I think that's what I would look for if I was hiring somebody. So that's good that he had it. And you know what I wouldn't want to have? A YouTube of me getting my back waxed, which is what I have right now. I can never go legitimate business person ever again. This radio thing has to work out for me.
Somebody, one of our listeners said, hey, you know, kids today just share everything, which is true. That's just, there's almost no filter button, right? Like, it's something that happens to you. You share it.
Yeah.
And he probably never thought where you or I might think, okay, Sean, that back waxing thing, it's not that bad. It's not like you're – the bad one is the one of Gallant and Straw with the – it's a creepy image. They had to do something with saran wrap.
No, that's me and Ted, dude.
Wait, you did that one?
Me and Ted had to wrap our faces in saran wrap and walk down the hallway with each of our mouths at the end of a pretzel stick. Like Lady and the Tramp with a spaghetti strand. It was brutal.
Wait, but that image didn't come up. That doesn't come up, though.
Will now. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
No. I don't know. I don't remember. The one with Gallant and Straw where they did it was like a disturbing image.
Okay,
it looked like something out of some weird independent horror film or something.
Oh, gotcha, because when Ted and I did it, it wasn't at all disturbing. It was a work of art. It was a damn Picasso.
No, it looked like some kind of, like, you see the image with Paul and Straw, as I remember it, maybe it's wrong, and it's almost like, wait a second, is this one of those two girls, one cup type of thing? Because I don't want to see this. Click. Get me out of here.
We've done a number on some Google searches in this segment. All right, it's people texting in, watching it now. Thanks a lot. All right. 2 days ago is the 10-year anniversary of Jim Crane buying the Astros. We have now had a decade of Crane. The good, the bad, the ugly. We relive a decade in a segment next. Good to be with you on a Tuesday, Sean Pendergast and Seth Payne. So, Seth, Twitter, this popped up yesterday. Now, granted, it was...
Something popped up on Twitter.
Something, believe it or not, something popped up on Twitter. But you get ready. Get ready. This is from Astros Daily. I saw this. This is as of Sunday, so it's 2 days ago, but...
Astros Daily on Twitter?
Yeah. Yeah.
I follow them. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I follow
them. I'm going to do that
good.
Right
it's
now.
A good Astros follow.
I say hold on. Keep going.
Yeah.
Just don't have all of our listeners hold on just so
while
I can
follow Astros Daily. We can multitask. As of, this is 5/16/2011, so May 16, 2011, 10 years ago, Sunday, the Astros announced the sale of the ball club to a group of investors led by Houston shipping magnate Jim Crane. Boy, I'd love to be called a magnate. That would
especially
be awesome.
A shipping magnate.
Yeah.
That sounds like old-time. That sounds like old-time wealth.
The reported price is $680 million. The sale awaits the approval of the other owners before becoming official. It ultimately became official. Now, it ultimately became official for $630 million because, gosh, as you recall, they were able to talk Jim Crane into a $50 million discount for the service of moving over to the American League.
Yeah.
Which got a lot of people irritated with Jim Crane right out of the chute back in the day.
A lot of people that immediately hated the designated hitter. That was, Sean, it's only really been in the last few years that we've stopped having some of our listeners complain about the designated hitter.
Yeah, I know.
Have you noticed that? I mean, it used to be, I would say still 4, 5, 6 years ago, we'd have the random people that would just either on the text line or on Twitter, just out of nowhere seemingly come in and complain to us about the designated hitter.
Yeah.
Which is an understandable. I mean, if you've been watching the AL your entire life, and then all of a sudden, boom, I get it. It's just... I guess we're winning a World Series put us completely and totally into the camp of the NL where nobody complains about the DL anymore or DH anymore.
Yeah, the AL. Yeah, where the DH is. Yeah, that or Yordan Alvarez. I mean, that would make me a real pro DH kind of guy. Having Yordan Alvarez on my team. So at any rate, it's been 10 years. So I thought about this. I said, okay. Overall, the good, the bad, the ugly with the Jim Crane decade of baseball. Because there's been some of all of it, Seth. There's been some good, there's been some bad, and there's been some ugly. The good, I think, and you, if you want to add on to this, 713-572-4610, obviously the World Series is the apex of this franchise's history. In 2017, winning a world championship. I would say the footprint of multiple years, 4 straight ALCS berths. That's obviously right there with it. For Jim Crane personally, I would say, Seth, other than the championships, as far as doing things that specifically owners can do, to me, he's lived up to or exceeded expectations in what I thought he would be in greenlighting big moves, big contracts, big trades. Hell, the Greinke deal, if you go back and unpack that, reportedly was Crane's idea. Crane went to Luno saying, why don't we go get Greinke? The Verlander trade, obviously, there's a lot of cost that came with that, that's still coming with that, with extending Verlander.
Yeah.
Crane has gone, to me, above and beyond what I thought he would be as an owner in terms of investing money. This is a team that's in the top five in payroll for the last several years.
Right, and without having the same revenue that those other teams do.
Yeah.
The Astros simply cannot command the same revenue that LA teams and New York teams do, and yet they're up there spending with them. It's really, for a guy who several years ago the question was, will he spend money when it comes time? When they start, back in 2014, really, and then 2015 as well, it was, okay, is this guy really going to commit to it? Will he be willing to spend when it's time to spend? And yeah, he's done it multiple times now.
Yeah. I mean, this team has made multiple big moves over the last several years. And I think, Seth, even during the pandemic, where you and I talked about this maybe a month or so ago when some numbers came out about which teams were hurt most by not having fans in the stands, the Astros were one of the top five teams estimated to have been hurt the worst in baseball, in part because the stadiums were empty, but also because, as you point out, proportionally, yeah, I mean, the Dodgers and the Yankees and those teams have empty stadiums, and they've got big payrolls, but they've got gigantic TV contracts. The Astros don't have that. So Crane even spending during the pandemic, bringing back Brantley, dropping $11 million a year on Oda Rizzi, I think are moves that are commendable.
Just by way of illustration, right now the top five teams per Spotrac, however you pronounce it,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the two New York teams, the two LA teams, and the Houston Astros.
Yeah.
Those are the five teams spending the most money in baseball. And the Dodgers, by the way, are just ridiculous this year, $255 million.
Yeah.
Over the Yankees, who have become relatively parsimonious at a paltry $201 million.
Parsimonious. That is a great word.
The parsimonious Yankees.
Yeah.
Something you haven't heard since like the 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the 1700s. Ah, these parsimonious Yankees, these colonials.
Ah, that John Adams.
His bunch of penny pinches.
He's been riding the same mayor for 7 years.
That's right. He's going to ride her into the ground. So Crane, as far as spending, and I think too, Seth, just spending money on payroll, and not a lot of bad contracts in there either. I mean, the Verlander contract is not good right now because he got hurt. But it's not as though they gave Verlander $33 million a year and then he turned into a guy with a 6.02 ERA or something like that.
Well, they've done it spending appropriately.
Yes.
And not doling out 10-year contracts.
That's the big thing.
That's where things get ugly, especially in the days of the luxury tax. And that's where the luxury tax has taken a while to kick in completely. And now the players would argue that it's kicked in with a vengeance because so few teams are even spending up close to the luxury tax.
Yeah.
That part of it, I know I saw some people, and I never know if it's an informed take or not. Like, I guess there's some arguments for trying to claim like letting Springer go was somehow the cheap thing to do or the cheap move. It just isn't. It's a smart financial move. Sometimes a smart financial move ends up being, it's the cheap thing to do, but it's because you don't want to spend money on an aging player that you'd be playing on until how long is Springer's contract?
6 years.
6 years. So he'll be 37 years old making that money for the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
That's a lot to spend on a guy
who's
37 years old.
Yeah, I had no problem with that. All right, so that's the good. The good is fairly obvious. The bad. All right, to me, the bad, and I guess we can debate and discuss if these are bad. Did you agree with firing A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luhnow when he did it, or should they have just ridden out the one-year suspension on each guy?
The way I viewed it, I think... I don't know if a deal was struck. I'm not going to get into conspiracy theories about all of that. It wouldn't surprise me if some kind of a deal was struck or if there was some kind of a wink-wink that...
With the commissioner, you mean? With
That, like, this will be it. This will be over and done with. And the commissioner, as much as people... I love that people love to pile on the commissioner for not stripping the World Series or not punishing the players. When it's really the Players Association itself that would have protected the Astros players. And if you had tried to punish the players themselves, it really would have been hard for baseball to do that, given the CBA. They probably wouldn't have been able to. So that would have been one more protracted fight. And the players themselves, so even though any of these clowns from the Dodgers acting like it was all the commissioner's fault. No. It's the Players Association was protecting the players. I'm okay with it. I mean, it wasn't. I would have preferred that AJ Hinch stuck around and Jeff Luhnow stuck around, but I get it.
Yeah,
if that's what it was.
And you replace AJ Hinch and Jeff Luhnow with Dusty Baker and James Click. It's yet to be determined if either of those guys are as good at their jobs as Hinch and Luhnow were. But we'll wait and see. I think longtime Astro fans would also say at the outset with the team when Jim Crane did not have enough pelts on the wall as an owner to get the benefit of the doubt, George Pistolas was the team president early on with this team and kind of cleaned house. And it was very, if you talk to people, it was very toxic behind the scenes early on during Jim Crane's tenure. He replaced him with Reed Ryan. That wound up being a good move, replacing at least for the mood behind the scenes. But Pistolas as president, I remember talking to people behind the scenes like, this is not fun working for this team right now.
That, you know, I guess that's... That's where it felt a little bit like the Texans right now, or the Texans right now feels in some respects like the Astros when Crane took over, and that there was a house cleaning. And look, it was a house cleaning for understandable and justifiable reasons, but the manner in which they were doing it raised a whole lot of eyebrows. Mm-hmm. And it felt wrong in a lot of ways. In some ways, it felt like they were like actively trying to distance themselves from their past. Like there's cost cutting, but then there's a kind of thumbing your nose at the past. With the Texans, I think there's been... It's been in a different manner, but there is this feeling that, okay, I understand what you're doing, but I don't really like the way you're going about it. And a lot of that is centered around Jack Easterby.
Yeah.
So George Postolos and Jack Easterby are completely different types of personalities and people, and their focus and their professional expertise is different. But I think there is a similar feeling of, man, it feels like there's a fox in the hen house.
Yes.
Like, what the hell is going on here? Something isn't right. I don't like the way this is going.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's the bad. The bad, I have it categorized as bad because you can recover from those. You know, if you didn't like firing Hinch and Luno, replacing with Dusty and Click might wind up being good. Replacing Postolos with Reed Ryan, I think, ended up being a good move. The ugly, Seth, is stuff that is just, that makes scars. It, you know, I don't know how much you recover from these. You just roll on with the scars on your face. But Brandon Taubman's existence in the organization, A, and then the handling of the Brandon Taubman situation where they smeared the journalist who reported Taubman's conduct after they won the AL.
Yeah.
That's something that you just, you know, you, I say you don't come back. Look, it's not like Crane had to sell the team or something like that, but that's just something like, that's, you're going to have to live with that. Well, that's a scar across your face that you're just going to have to live with going forward.
And that one, that whole 1 year stretch, or what, 4 or 5 month stretch where the Taubman incident happened, then the commissioner's report was released, and then there was the awkward press conference
mm-hmm.
where with the apologies.
That's my next one, the bad apologies.
Yeah,
well,
so let's roll into those awkward apologies and include the PR nightmare that was the denial of the Brandon Taubman incident, that actual press conference, where when the players could speak freely about it after the press conference, I thought they did a pretty good job. The problem was nobody in baseball saw any of those because that wasn't the crown jewel centerpiece that the press conference was. All of that was, I think, really, just frankly, some really bad PR work by the Astros.
Horrible.
And Crane ultimately is responsible for hiring the PR professionals mm-hmm. responsible for those missteps. And ultimately he's the captain of the ship with that part of it. But I doubt Crane was crafting the messages that were sent necessarily in those moments.
Yeah.
And so he let, woe to Frey, I guess if it were the NCAA, he had lost institutional control.
Yeah.
He had, like, at some point he needed to have more, he needed more checks and balances within the organization.
If you had to give Jim Crane a letter grade for his first 10 years as owner, what would you give him? Taking all the things.
His first 10 years?
His first 10 years, the body of work, the 10 years, all the stuff that you and I just spent the last 12 minutes bullet pointing here, what would you give him? I've got a grade in my mind that I would give him. I'm curious what yours is.
If it weren't for the PR disasters.
Yeah.
In which, the problem was with Luno, I think you gave free license for Luno to do things in a revolutionary manner, and yet somehow, you know, there's always something lacking on the human side with somebody like Jeff Luno.
Yep.
And if he's going to go that far out there with what he's doing, you should have somehow reined him in a little bit
yeah.
and made him understand, or at least say, hey, look, when Major League Baseball sends out a memo, at the very least, be sure the people in the organization see the damn
yep.
memo about
yep.
cheating. So I'd have to, but they got a World Series championship.
They did. It's a complex grade, man.
So I'd have to go from an A+ to an A-.
Okay.
Because of that.
I was in the B+, A- range as well. I was kind of straddling. If it was a number grade, I'd give him like an 89.5, that kind of thing. Like right
yeah.
there, B+, A-. My feeling, Seth, has always been when you're an owner of a major sports team, there's three things that we're grading you on. How well do you hire people? How much resource do you give those people? And what's the overall impression in the community of your team? And I think Crane's done an incredible job of hiring. I think he's gone out of his way over and above to give resources. I think that third one, though, he's got some major bruises and scars from they've done a ton of great things in the community, obviously. They've done a lot of great community work, but just the overall impression of the Astros, when you mention the Astros still publicly, not just here in Houston, but around the country, the first thing people think of is the sign-stealing scandal. And that matters. That goes on your report card. But I would say overall, a really good owner, Jim Crane, no doubt about it, 10 years in. All right, let's get to some headlines.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines, brought to you by BaywayJeep.com.
All right, speaking of the Astros and speaking of headlines, good news if you're somebody that's looking to get back out to Major League Baseball games here in Houston. The Astros are going back to 100% capacity, baby. That is right, 100% capacity at Minute Maid Park starting next Tuesday when the Dodgers come to town. Also, if you're vaccinated, the Astros are saying you don't have to wear masks either. So maximum capacity for the remainder of the season. They're going to be putting additional tickets on sale for some of the games where they've been selling tickets for limited capacity. And single-game tickets for all games beyond June 3rd will be going on sale for the first time next Friday, May 28th. So, Seth, chalk one up for normalcy. We're getting back to it here at Minute Maid Park.
So we will, I'm guessing there will be sellouts for at least the first few times this happens. It helps that it's versus the Dodgers.
Yeah.
So that's a Tuesday night
Tuesday?
Versus the Dodgers.
Tuesday and Wednesday, and the school year is still going, though.
Ooh.
So do you want to pump the brakes on sellouts, or do you want to still go all in with your chips on the sellout?
What's the percentage of schools that are fully back in full attendance?
I don't know. I know the one my wife teaches at is back at full.
She's
attendance.
100% full yes. attendance all the time. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I know. I'm just thinking of like in some of the
well,
some
unless,
of the
100%. I know if you want to. I mean, there are still some kids doing Zoom because their parents are keeping them at home. And
I'm just thinking about my mom's experience. So she teaches in an area where it's still largely remote, and she's pretty sure that she might have 25% attendance at any given time.
Right.
So
there's some kids getting behind, man.
Kids log in and it's you talk about loss of institutional control.
Right, right.
I mean, they don't
messing with the Zoom.
Yeah.
Well, but she teaches at a, you know, she teaches for a school where very few kids have high speed internet or anything. So they've got the hotspots that they've donated.
Oh, wow.
I can't remember which companies. A company donated a bunch of hotspots, but they still have only so much data.
Yeah.
You know, so they don't ask the kids to use up all their data on video streaming, so they kind of punch in and they're supposedly listening. It's not going well.
Do you think we're on the cusp of a boom summer here with all the reopen? Like, all the restaurants and bars that have managed to weather the storm?
Yeah.
I mean, look, a lot of them are having a hard time finding help. That's the big thing right now.
Yeah, I think the I don't want to turn this into a political show or anything. They've got to make some decisions about how to keep the economy from going off the rails. Well, they need labor. Yeah,
yeah.
We need labor.
Yeah.
We need people to fill some of these jobs. Or prices are going to get ridiculous and absurd.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think yes, there's a chance for a real boom, but there's some questions as to how well we can handle a boom and
no
what's going to happen because of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that this thing, I think we can all agree on. There's definitely an overall willingness to start to get back out and do. Like, people are itching to get back out and do things, is my sense. A lot of people are.
It's now, Sean, you made the cardinal mistake, Sean.
Which is what?
Of talking about when school is over.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody is convinced that in their school district, that's the actual calendar.
Ah.
That, you know, so yeah. So you're wrong, Sean. This is the last week of school.
Oh, okay.
According to multiple listeners.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Sorry, listen. Hey, Seth, the NBA play-in, not the playoff, the play-in begins tonight. We get two Eastern Conference NBA games, including, I don't do this very often, but I'm going to give you guys a pick right here. I'm giving you, Ben, record this. I'm giving you a lock tonight. The Washington Wizards and Russell Westbrook are going to go into Boston and do the Boston Celtics tonight. And you are getting, I believe, two and a half points with the Wizards. The Wizards are 17-6 in their last 23 games. The Celtics are missing Jaylen Brown, and they've been playing like crap down the stretch. And I feel like they're just folding up tents. Whereas Washington, a frisky Russell Westbrook in the playoffs could be kind of fun. But at any rate, for those who don't know, the next two nights, well, really the next four nights, are a four-team play-in in the Eastern and Western Conference involving the 7-10 seeds. Tonight are the two Eastern Conference games, and tomorrow are the two Western Conference games, including a LeBron versus Steph game tomorrow night a play-in game where the winner will clinch a playoff spot.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
I think probably at this point, most of America really wants LeBron to lose. Is that fair to say?
Would you like me to put up a poll?
See put up a poll, think? Yeah. Are you rooting for, and don't word it, who do you want, Steph or LeBron, or maybe word it, are you rooting for LeBron to lose?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, inherently, LeBron and Steph,
it matters how it's worded.
Okay.
It matters how it's worded.
I'll wait till the break, and then you and I will figure out the exact way to word this here. Are you rooting against LeBron? At any rate, it should make for some great theater.
LeBron whining and crying about this play-in when, like, he's got nobody to blame but himself and his team for being where they are.
Yeah.
Are you seriously sitting here and acting like a snob because you're the seventh seed and you shouldn't have to deign to play into this most prestigious of all tournaments, the National Basketball Association playoffs?
Seth, a year ago he was espousing for a play-in. He thought a play-in was a great idea because he didn't have to participate in it.
Yeah.
Now that he's
got
to play in it, it's the worst idea ever. Yeah, LeBron's. He's ridiculous.
I'm all for it. Like, honestly, if you don't want to play in, then don't be an 8 seed. Yeah. Don't be a 7 seed. It just you're taking that spot of the least respected position in the playoffs, particularly in the NBA.
Yeah.
And there are exceptions here and there, but largely from year to year, I like this. I think more competition, more play-ins always.
Do you, Seth? Do you have a former Rocket from the Harden era? That because they're all in the playoffs, do you have a particular Harden era former Rocket that you're rooting for more than others in the postseason this year in the NBA? You got Chris Paul. Yeah, just to refresh, you got Chris Paul in Phoenix. You got Russ in Washington. You have Harden himself in Brooklyn. Dwight's in Philly. Capella's in Atlanta. PJ Tucker's in Milwaukee. It's hard to find a playoff team that does not include a former Houston Rocket. Do you have one
Capella,
in particular that you're rooting for?
I would say maybe Capella, just because Capella is what might have been.
Yeah.
I guess if things hadn't gone awry and Capella had continued to develop and you'd played a more conventional variety of basketball. And think about that, what I'm saying right now, that somehow the Rockets, when it was Harden and Capella and pre-Westbrook, that was somehow a more conventional variety of basketball. That's how far out they got from conventional basketball. Yeah, I'll pull for Capella.
Yeah,
I've always loved that little Swiss bastard.
little seven-footer. You cutie.
He used to be kind of little. When he first got here, he was a boy. Remember? Remember he came back yoked? A couple of years ago, and you're like, damn, the kid done went through puberty in the offseason.
He always worked hard at his game, man. If you ever got to a Rocket game early, Capella was always out there shooting those little elbow jumpers. He never got good at them, but he tried. Remember he had an incentive in his contract for free throws if he could shoot over 60% or something like that?
He steadily got better at free throws,
he did.
He'd shoot 53s after every practice.
He did.
He was going to become the new age center that we're now all of a sudden it seems like they're everywhere.
Yeah. We got Christian Wood instead right now, so there you go. Next headline. We don't talk much horse racing on the show, but Bob Baffert, this is how bereft of headlines we are today.
Well, this is, I don't know, just from watching, and I hardly ever watch ESPN with the sound on. Yeah. I just kind of have it on to see what's going on. I feel like maybe we missed the boat on Bob Baffert.
All right,
they've been talking a lot of Bob Baffert. I don't think they're even talking horse racing as much as they're talking Bob Baffert with a lot of this doping scandal.
Well, let me read the news story here, and then you tell me if we've been underplaying this here. Bob Baffert was suspended Monday from entering horses at New York racetracks pending an investigation into Kentucky Derby winner Medina Spirit's failed post-race drug test. Now, they ran the Preakness this past week, and Medina Spirit did not win the Preakness. So there will be no Triple Crown for Bob Baffert, who's won the Triple Crown a couple times before as a trainer. Baffert temporarily will not be allowed to stable any horses at Belmont, Aqueduct, or Saratoga. Those are all in New York, or run any of his horses at the New York Racing Association's tracks. That ban includes races at Belmont, and the Belmont Stakes are coming up on June 5th. There's a statement from the NYRA president talking about maintaining a successful industry and integrity of the sport. Baffert had not committed to entering any horses in the third leg of the Triple Crown, but had many in consideration for other races in Belmont Stakes on that day of the Belmont Stakes. So, Seth, you tell me, have we not been talking about Bob Baffert, probably the preeminent trainer in horse racing, having a dirty horse win the Kentucky Derby, possibly.
No, I don't think. I think we've been okay, and I think it's this is the reason why. I think Bob Baffert is more of a TV phenomenon because of his hair and his sunglasses.
Great head of hair, no doubt.
He just kind of, but he also kind of looks like a sketchy dude that would be involved on the fringe. I know he's not a fringe character in horse racing, but this is largely a made-for-TV scandal. I don't think it translates well over into radio. I think we've been okay.
Okay,
do a poll on that one, too. Have we underreported the Bob Baffert saga?
I've already got one poll up today about football playing Jesse. What percentage of people had heard the phrase football playing Jesse?
Where are we on that?
David Culley.
Football playing Jesse.
Yeah, say it one more time, Ben. Hit that high key.
Football playing Jesse.
Call Garrett Wallow of football playing Jesse. What percentage of people do you think had heard that phrase before Saturday when David Culley made it sound like everybody's heard that phrase? It's a common phrase in the South. What percentage of people had heard that phrase before Saturday? In my poll.
I'm guessing that it was, I don't know, we've got a couple of our listeners said their dads used to say it.
Okay.
So I'm going to guess 25%.
6%.
6%.
6% of people, of the 565 votes thus far this morning, 6% had heard the phrase.
Football playing Jesse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, even a lot of our listeners that said they'd heard it had heard their dad saying, like, that guy's a hardworking Jesse. That is just now, and then the other part, Amy, your wife said that on Urban Dictionary it says that it's something that somebody from the north says disparaging about somebody from the south.
Yeah, to call
I wonder if that's cowardly. I wonder if that's an Uncle Jesse.
Yeah,
like Uncle Jesse from Dukes of Hazzard.
Do you think he was soft and cowardly? I thought he was.
No, he wasn't cowardly, was he?
No, he was patriarchal.
He let the Duke boys do most of the dirty work.
He was smart. Yeah. He delegated. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, he was too old to be doing a lot of this. Oh, boy, now I'm going to do one of those things where I go back and I see, how old was the actor who played Uncle Jesse? And it's going to turn out that he was actually 39 or something. Dude. But when you're a kid, he looks like the oldest man ever. Oh, he looks like the oldest man alive.
No, that's the best, Seth. Those memes where they've got like Wilford Brimley like was the same age in Cocoon as Tom Brady when he won the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, or All in the Family. That was the most recent one.
Oh, yeah, Carol O'Connor.
Carol O'Connor in the first season of All in the Family was like 48 years old. And you think of him as being old as dirt.
Okay, I put who is Uncle Jesse and it says John Philip Stamos. That's Full House Uncle Jesse. I need Uncle Jesse from Dukes of Hazzard. Come on now.
There were two Uncle Jesse.
John Denver, Stamos still Denver looks Pyle. The same, too.
His name was Denver Pyle. There was one time in his life where he didn't have a beard. He's 77 years old right now, Sean.
No, he's not. He was 77 when he died in 1997.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, that wouldn't make any sense at all. He was old.
He was 37 when he was Uncle Jesse.
He died in 1997 at the age of 77. So I'm guessing Dukes of Hazzard first came out in like the mid-1980s?
It was late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, the Dukes of Hazzard.
So he was like upper 50s or 60 or so. So at least he was like he was great uncle age at that point. Okay,
yeah.
I feel better about that.
I'm not going to lie, he looked older than that age though. Like he was, I got to see when the Dukes of Hazzard went on the air. By the way, you're listening to KILT and KILT HD2, an Odyssey station.
We're a sports station.
Yeah, the Dukes of Hazzard, 1979 to 1985. So 1979, that's 18 years. Blah, blah, blah. 60. So he was 61 when the Dukes of Hazzard started up. He looked older than 61 to me, but that's because they dressed him older. You turn the music down.
Yeah, they make him old.
Yeah, they have him in overalls, and he's looking all dumpy and frumpy and whatnot. He's got the trucker cap on and things like that.
The other, the other thing I like to do when I'm watching old stuff is looking at how our definition of what a chubby person is has changed. Because the chubby guy, the chubby kid on any 1970s or 80s sitcom invariably looks like pretty much all of us now. We're like, we're all like, hey, I lost 30 pounds. I'm down to chubby kid from 8 is enough.
Right.
Yes, that's. I look great. I look incredible. I was watching Sean, I was watching Little Rascals yesterday. And I'm like, you know what? That fat kid isn't actually all that fat.
Who, Spanky?
Yeah. You were just kind of, why did I used to think this kid was fat? He's just kind of normal looking.
You were watching The Little Rascals yesterday?
It was at my television. My television has some kind of, I don't even know what channel it is. It's like, it just shows old, if I hit the home key enough, it kind of reverts back to some weird channel that I've never heard of before that just has, it plays old royalty-free movies and stuff all the time. It was pretty funny, man. Spanky was laying in bed. He wouldn't go to sleep. His parents were getting very frustrated with him to the point where they stopped coming in to check on little Spanky.
Yeah.
This is when Spanky was very little, very cute. So then all of a sudden, a cat burglar shows up. Now, this guy was fat. It was very ironic because it's this fat cat burglar. And of course, he's saying, "Dad, come, there's the boogeyman is here." And then it starts to get super creepy because the boogeyman's like looking at little Spanky and realizing that the father's not going to come rescue little Spanky. And you're like, oh boy, where is this going?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what's going on. But it ended up being pretty funny, actually. It didn't go down the dark, dark path that it looked like it was going down for a second.
Alfalfa, little trivia for you, Seth. I was listening to a Sopranos podcast this week, and the actors that do that podcast that played Bobby Bacala and Chrissy. Yeah. On The Sopranos, they somehow got on a tangent about the Little Rascals. Alfalfa got the job as Alfalfa. He was sightseeing at the studios there with his family, and they said, oh my God, look at this kid. Hey, read these lines. You would be perfect for this. And he winds up getting the job as Alfalfa. How about that? You never
I
know.
I think that's a fake story.
I think that's what
his parents claimed.
They told it on that podcast, and I'm looking at Wikipedia, and that's what it says right there in Wikipedia.
Yeah, but that sounds like some little stage mom that was like, oh my, I didn't even realize that my Alfalfa had any kind of aspirations towards acting, even though we've had him in classes
real name
for the last 5 years. Look at my child just sitting here taking a tour. Recite that Shakespeare we went over last night, please.
His name was Carl Switzer. It was his name.
Carl Switzer.
Yeah. My young Carl Switzer. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Tuesday. Thus ends our Little Rascals segment of the show.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.